The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're talking about neurology. From its early beginnings to the cutting-edge research advancing our understanding of the brain. We'll bring you a panel discussion with Dr. Steve Novella and Dr. Jason Schneiderman that we recorded live at this year's Dragon Con in Atlanta. But first, let's find out about a new technique that can actually take pictures of what your brain is seeing. Sort of. I'm here with Dr. Thomas Nazalaris, who is currently doing his postdoctorate in neuroscience at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the co-author of an absolutely fascinating study that just came out of Jack Gallant's lab. Thanks for being here, Thomas.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start out by saying that when I first read about your research, I initially assumed it was pseudoscience. And I also assume you've heard that before.
No, it's not bunk. They have gotten the impression that it's bunk because of the potential applications of the work. They sound fantastic, but the work itself is very straightforward science. No one in the field, at least no one in our field, would see this as anything other than sort of a really straightforward application of things that people have known about the brain, about the visual system in particular, for quite a long time.
But you guys have figured out a way to reconstruct the visions that we see in our minds.
I would take the last two words of that sentence out. It's the visions that we see.
Right.
There's a distinction, and it's a very important one, between reconstructing something that you're seeing with your eyes, an image that has been transduced by the retina and is making its way into your brain. Okay, so that's what we've done. We've reconstructed that.
How did you do that?
There's two stages, really. The first thing you do is to build a model that relates some feature of the images that you see, some features of images, to the activity in your brain. A decent metaphor is this model is like a dictionary that translates images into the code or the language that a certain part of your brain speaks. An image that you see in the world, you can describe it in many different ways. Consider a black and white image. All it is a list of numbers, and each number corresponds to how bright a pixel is. You can describe an image also in terms of like a list of objects, right? I'm looking at a dog and a cat and a person and a building. And then there's lots of intermediate descriptions. You can describe an image as just a set of edges and textures. Each one of these descriptions is valid and corresponds to something interesting about the image. And your vision system, which is composed of something like 75 different areas, creates lots of different descriptions of an image. What we've done is to build a model that translates the images that you see into a code or a description of an image that is particular to a certain set of visual areas, not very many synapses away from the retina. This is a model that's based on almost the first or maybe second level of processing that goes on in the vision system. But once you have this dictionary, it's sort of trivial to go back and forth between predicting what the brain is going to do when you see an image or predicting what an image looks like, at least at some level of description when the brain, you know, responds to it.
Well, maybe tell me about the study design.
It couldn't be simpler, really. Subjects get into a functional magnetic resonance imaging scanner used for the specific purpose of measuring basically blood flow in the brain. And they watch movies. They have to keep their eyes fixed on a little dot at the center of the screen. And we do that so we know absolutely certain what the input is to the retina. And while they're looking at these movies, we record what's called bold activity. And so then we end up with a bunch of data. And the data really is a set of numbers that describe how the brain, at least in terms of the bold activity, responded to these movies. And then that's when this modeling begins. After we get this data and we have it on our computers, that's when we start developing these models that allow us to translate between movies and brain activity.
So after you recorded all the data, you used a group of clips to reconstruct the videos that were shown to the subjects?
What our models really tell us, right? So the dictionary metaphor is useful, but kind of at a more formal level, what our models tell us is what is the likelihood that you would record any specific pattern activity in the brain, given that the subject was looking at some specific movie. So the model, I mean, to be technical, is called a conditional probability distribution. It just sort of says, what are the likely states of that the brain could be in when you're looking at a certain movie? So to do decoding, I mean, once you have this set of probabilities, decoding is kind of simple. You get a ton of movies, okay? In this case, 18 million one-second clips. And you kind of compare them against this list of probabilities. You say, what is the probability that we would have seen the brain pattern that we actually did see if the subject were looking at clip A or clip B or clip C or clip D? And you go all the way down the line. You know, you do this to all 18 million of these YouTube clips.
And by you mean a computer.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
One does this.
Really. Right.
Yes. So then you take the 100 clips, say, that are most likely to have resulted in this pattern of activity that you actually recorded. Once you have that list of, you know, the kind of the best, most likely candidates, you can do lots of things. What we did in this study is just to average them together. Okay, so you just blend them together just with a simple average. And that in fact, is why the reconstructions, they look kind of blurry. And that's because, you know, if I'm looking at a movie of a face, then this algorithm that we've developed is going to most likely pick out from our you know, big library of 18 million clips, other movies that have people's faces in them. And you know, all 100 of them. If you average 100 faces together, it still looks kind of like a face, but it's sort of a blurry face.
And we will actually be including a link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com to the videos, so you can see for yourselves what they look like. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Thomas Nazalaris, who is currently doing his postdoctorate in neuroscience at the University of California, Berkeley, and is the co-author of a study into using brain activity to reconstruct our visual experience. So now this is what I want to know. What are the practical applications of this research? Because I've been reading a lot of articles about this, and they definitely sort of range from the quite practical to the fantastical.
There is a step that needs to be taken before any practical application comes out of this work. The step of applying this decoding algorithm, or this method we have for reconstructing visual experiences, to internally generated visual experience. So I'm talking about an image that you might see while daydreaming or while trying to remember some landmark that you've seen or the face of someone that you used to know. Those visual experiences are vivid. They're real. There's no question they exist because everyone you talk to has them. And you know that they seem to be a really important part of our mental life. But they're obviously importantly different from the images that we see as we're just walking around the world with our eyes open. If we couldn't tell the difference between them, we'd have trouble getting around in the world. So it isn't known right now if the algorithm that we've designed, which is basically just a way of applying basic knowledge about perception and about the way our visual systems work, we don't know if that knowledge actually is applicable to the case when you're imagining an image as opposed to seeing. Now, there are some who will argue that imagining an image, at least at a neural level, is just like kind of a noisy, low-level replication of seeing an image. If that's the case, then we should be able to apply this brain reading algorithm pretty easily in a pretty straightforward way. It may not be the case, but to answer your question, we're going to have to assume that it is. So then, what can you do? One possibility, I think a really concrete and kind of useful possibility, would be to have a new method for determining whether a patient who has become unconscious because of a stroke or some other injury. With these patients, you sort of have no idea what's going on in their brains or
right.
In their minds. You know they're alive, they're breathing, their heart rate might be fine, all their other organs are working, but you have no idea what's going on in their heads because they can't talk, they can't respond to you. It would be fantastic if we could access that content, at least you know, use our knowledge of vision to at least access that part of what's going on in their minds. If I had to guess, I would think that something like that would be the first, you know, concrete application of this. Now, as for the more fantastical applications, you know, a lot of this is limited by the brain recording technology. We're using, like I said, fMRI to actually record the signals that we're using to reconstruct the images. And fMRIs is not portable. This is really a massive machine that requires a magnet, in our case, that is a 3 Tesla magnet, which you can't bring anywhere because it will, you know, suck buildings into it.
Right.
You have to operate these things behind these massive magnetic shields. So really, it's kind of like, you know, if you can imagine a general mind reading device, or let's say, you know, we have a general mind reading device. We don't have it yet, but let's say we were to build one using this technology. My opinion about what you could do with that is almost irrelevant, because anyone could come up with 100 interesting applications. That's the point at which, you know, the scientists are sort of done, and people in other parts of society would take over at that point. You know, artists and businessmen and things like that.
You know, since we're butting up against the Great Wall of Speculation, I might as well just climb over. Could this technology be used on animals? Like, how much reconfiguration would that actually take to see what a chimp or a dolphin could see?
We know a lot about the similarities, I would say, between the human visual system and the visual systems of other mammals. So at the most kind of basic level of visual processing, things look very similar across a number of mammalian species, cats, monkeys, humans. And in fact, I should say that a number of years ago, a study just like ours, using slightly different methods, was reported using a cat model. So this was reporting in an even earlier structure in the visual system. They managed to reconstruct movies from a cat brain. Now, the question is, in order to read a cat's mind in the way that people are speculating we'll be able to do with humans, cats and monkeys or whatever animal you're talking about need to have an internal mental life that's a lot like ours. Or at least it needs to be as similar to ours as their visual systems are as similar to ours. That's a huge unopened question. I don't think anyone would rule out the fact that animals have very rich internal mental, at least visual experiences, but we don't know.
I have trouble describing this. This is both amazing and fairly creepy, in a good way.
Yeah.
Really.
Again, it's a precursor to amazing and creepy. It is a demonstration that a certain body of knowledge that has been built up by other neuroscientists over decades of work, it's a demonstration that they really have a pretty deep understanding of at least a certain part of the brain, the parts of the brain that we're actually recording from to do this image reconstruction. And so I think it's a milestone or a landmark in the sense that it's an application of all this knowledge that's been built up by many other people. You know, there's a big gap between what we've done and what might be possible. Some truly, you know, creepy or fantastic applications. And we just don't know how big that gap is yet.
Thanks for your work, Thomas, and thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks.
You can find a link to the Gallant Lab at UC Berkeley on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with the live show I did at DragonCon a few weeks ago with guest neurologists Stephen Novella and Jason Schneiderman after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're recording live from the podcast track at DragonCon in Atlanta, Georgia. And tonight we're talking neurology with Stephen Novella, academic clinical neurologist at Yale University School of Medicine, and he's also the author of the blog Neurologica. You may also know him from the very popular weekly science podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And he's also a founding fellow of the Institute for Science and Medicine. And welcome back, Steve.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us today is Dr. Jason Schneiderman. And Jason has a PhD in neuroscience from the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. He's currently doing postdoctoral research investigating the early stages of schizophrenia and white matter development. And he's at the Psychiatry Neuroimaging Laboratory in Brigham and Women's Hospital of Harvard Medical School. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
So since Steve's been on the show before, he doesn't get to start. We will start with the new guy. Jason, the psychiatric neuroimaging. So first of all, what is that?
It actually started out the laboratory as part of a radiology laboratory, and it became a way to leverage the new and possibly very useful tools in radiology and apply them to some of the most puzzling diseases in the behavioral sciences and neurology and psychiatry. The name is not entirely accurate. We span neurology and psychiatry. We've been doing a lot of work recently on traumatic brain injury, as well as work on post-traumatic stress disorder, schizophrenia. We do a few studies on genetic diseases that affect the brain, such as something called 22q11 deletion syndrome or velocardiofacial syndrome. So it started out as a very small portion of a radiology lab, and it split off from there. We are given these great tools that get developed by the radiologists we work very closely with, and the other scientists, the mathematicians and the computer scientists. And they say, is this going to be useful? And we're the test bed for a lot of new hardware and software, including a program called Slicer, which is funded by the NIH and is used across different fields of radiology research. I've seen it use everything from prostates through lungs through brains.
So how are the imaging techniques used in the study of schizophrenia specifically?
Well, in the study of schizophrenia, what we use most often is MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. Specifically, something called diffuse intensity imaging is what our group specializes in. And there's been a long-standing theory going back over 100 years that schizophrenia involves the disconnection between parts of the mind, then moving on to disconnections between parts of the brain. And until recently, with advances in imaging, it's been very difficult to study this, especially in people who are otherwise healthy, because the problem is if you stick to just microscopy work, you're going to be looking at people who have been on some very powerful drugs for extended periods of time and have been institutionalized, and a lot of them have been self-medicated. So we use advanced imaging techniques to look at the circuitry of the brain, and we've actually come up with some good evidence that it indeed is the circuitry, this white matter, this wiring, that contributes to some of the symptomology in schizophrenia, specifically problems with self-monitoring and judging internal from external. And the most common form of this is hearing voices, auditory hallucinations, where patients will think that something that is internally generated, a monologue, so to speak, we all have them, the voices in our heads that say, oh, this is a dumb move, well, should I go get pizza today? Or, you know, sometimes you could actually hear your mother yelling at you in your head going, oh, you shouldn't be doing that, or you forgot to call me today. And they basically misjudge these as externally generated. And there's a whole category of others. They think motor control is being externally forced on them. They feel like they say it's sort of puppets on a string. It's something called illusion of control. There's also what they consider thought insertion, which is where the CIA or aliens or, you know, some other greater force is broadcasting thoughts into their brain. And basically it's them having the inability to recognize their own self-generated thoughts or self-generated movements or self-generated language.
Okay, now we know what Jason does. So,
it's part of what
Steve,
I do.
Academic clinical neurology. That sounds like everything else.
It's basically, I'm a neurologist. I'm a clinician. I see patients, but I do it in an academic setting, and I do it in the context of teaching medical students, residents, and fellows. So when I'm seeing a patient, there's a fellow there or a student or whatever, and I'm teaching them how to be a neurologist, basically. So that's the academic part. I do some research. It's a minority of what I do. My academic focus is in teaching, so that's where my emphasis is.
No, I'm actually very excited because when I listen to Steve's podcast, I never actually hear him talk enough, in my opinion, about neurology. So this is helpful. But when you're talking to patients, do you use the imaging techniques that Jason uses?
No. Generally, there are research imaging techniques that have not penetrated into the clinical realm, and it's often the path that new diagnostic techniques, it's not limited to imaging, will take first. They have to be studied to see, you know, what do they do, what kind of information do we get from them. That information has to be validated, and then the clinical relevance has to be sorted out. There's a lot of situations where, for example, like with schizophrenia is classic for this, but there's many, many situations where this is the case, where we're looking for statistical differences between a population of, you know, the general population and a population of some identified entity like schizophrenia. There are statistical differences between the way that the brains are working over here versus over there. That's different than taking an individual patient and or individual person and looking at their brain and sorting them into one category or the other. In order to be clinically useful, you would need to be able to do that. And so while there are lots of techniques which are useful for research but are just not useful clinically because they don't tell you anything about an individual person. They only tell you something about a population of patients with a disease versus the general population. In clinical neurology, we use a lot of MRI techniques. I mean, that's been around for 20-plus years, in the early 90s when they really started coming to broad use clinically. And over the years, the computer and software technology has advanced incredibly, as well as, you know, Moore's Law applies to anything that is basically crunching information, including all of the data that comes back from the MRI machine. So newer and newer techniques have been added to our repertoire, you know, different ways of looking at the brain, looking at the blood flow to the brain, of swelling in the brain, emphasizing different aspects of the anatomy. So now we can have a patient who comes in with a stroke-like syndrome. I say stroke-like syndrome rather than stroke because we don't know that it's a stroke. That's the question. Is it a migraine? Is it a stroke? Is it something else? And we can do an MRI on them immediately, and we can say, oh, look at this. This wedge of the brain is not being perfused, and it's starting to swell. That's a stroke. And we know for 100% certain that the patient had a stroke in a very particular distribution, whereas 20 years ago we would do a CAT scan, make sure they weren't bleeding, and then we would have to wait for a day or more to see the stroke evolve on CAT scan. Now we know in minutes if they're having a stroke.
Now, the idea that our brains are important for anything at all is rather new, relatively. When did people begin to suspect that our mental faculties were actually in our brains?
That goes back at least a few hundred years, where there was actually something that we would call neurology, where there was the study of the brain as the organ of consciousness, mentation, thinking, you know, controlling the body. Before then, there were various beliefs. I mean, you know, depending on the culture, you go back to the ancient Egyptians, of course, they thought the liver was the seat of consciousness. They didn't recognize that the brain was actually doing anything useful. And, you know, the brain doesn't have much in the way of moving parts. I mean, it's a bunch of gray jelly. It does seem like a fairly worthless organ unless you have pretty advanced techniques of looking at the way the cells are connecting to each other, and you realize, this is a computer. You know, these are all new concepts. So it really was in the 1700s, you know, where the serious study of the brain as the organ of mentation was taking off, and that's where you had the really early discussions about brain organization were happening. Like the most basic concepts of the brain were still being worked out. Like, for example, is the brain compartmentalized, meaning that one part of the brain is responsible for one particular function, or are all the functions of the brain distributed pretty much evenly throughout the brain, just as sort of a mishmash? And you know, that debate turned out to be that, you know, yeah, well, the brain is very, very compartmentalized. There's lots of different parts of the brain that have very specific functions or are more, where that fight's still going on, actually, in that, but just on a much more sophisticated level. With the kind of research Jason is doing, we'll look at the circuitry in the brain, and we can identify specific parts of the brain that are active during certain tasks. But what is that part of the brain contributing to that task? Is it like a graphics processor in a computer, where that's the very specific place where graphics processing is taking place? Or is it more the connections that it's making with other parts of the brain that's really important? So this is the module versus network discussion that's going on? Is the brain more, and we know it's not diffuse goo, right? It is, there are structures, pretty microscopic, important structures all over the brain. And we do know that one specific place of the brain will have one specific function. But when you get to like the really sophisticated functions like reality testing, you know, again, the kind of thing Jason's talking about with schizophrenia, or the sense of ownership, the sense of distinguishing self from the outside, these are like the highest level of sophisticated mental functions. We see networks of areas of the brain communicating with each other, and there are certain parts of the brain that seem to be involved in certain functions, but they can have different functions when they network with other parts of the brain. So they take place with different networks. So it seems that both are true, that there are modules that network.
And one of the things that actually this new imaging technologies have shown us is that this difference between modules and networked systems actually changes during development. And one of my particular areas of interest personally and professionally is the fact that it seems during childhood the brain is a lot more modular, and the distributed networks don't start to come online for a lot of higher function for things like long-term planning, reality testing, and basically the brain goes from a bunch of modules that do talk to each other to a very distributed type of processing for higher levels of cognition, what most of us would consider hard things to think about, like ethics, morality, emotional regulation. And this is really what's happening during the adolescent years. And we've actually shown that this development also extends into the early 20s. You know, a lot of clinical neurologists and pediatricians will think, oh, the brain is developed by the time you hit adolescence. And, you know, one of the things that our techniques have shown is that, you know, your brain is still developing and still changing up until, you know, well past, you know, last few years of puberty.
This is amazing new research that we know about. Can you tell us about some of the history of brain-related treatments? Because we're here now, but where did we come from? I'm looking for horrible stories, sir.
One story that sticks in my head, excuse the pun, and because it actually... the person's skull is in our medical library at Harvard, is the tale of Phineas Gage. In neurology, neuroscience, he's a very famous case. He was a railroad worker. He was putting explosives in with a tamping rod. They ignited. The tamping rod went through his skull, and he survived. But he was a completely changed person. He had no emotional control. He went from being a very nice, very polite man to someone who would get into a lot of fights. He became a drunkard and a gambler. And this is when we started, during the time which the argument is going on about is stuff localized or is it distributed. And it was cases like Gage where you had an relatively isolated area of the brain that was damaged, and you saw specific changes. But he was still able to do things. He could still walk. He could still talk. He was still a human being, still alive, still conscious, but his personality had completely changed. And you see a lot of this these days in people who have strokes, or in one of the areas I'm getting into a lot more now has been traumatic brain injury. And you'll see someone who comes back from even a diffuse traumatic brain injury, like being caught in an explosion or being in a car accident and getting a concussion. And they'll say, you know, my memory's not what it used to be, or, you know, I now get dizzy all the time. So that's sort of where things have come from.
I think the crudest mechanism that we use to try to alter brain function is surgical. Now, not to say that neurosurgery isn't a very important specialty. If you have to take a tumor out, you know, you need a neurosurgeon. But even up into still today, there were a number of situations where we try to alter the function of the brain by destroying certain pathways in the brain. The most notorious one situation there is frontal lobotomy. You know, that which is not done anymore. But there you were, you know, cutting some of the frontal lobe circuits and essentially doing surgically what happened to Phineas Gage accidentally. But we also do things do surgery to treat movement disorders. So, for example, there are circuits deep in the brain that are not really controlling how we think, but they do affect our movements. And this is for things like a serious tremor with Parkinson's disease, for example. And we would, you know, not really done anymore because other techniques have supplanted it, but certainly while I was in medical school in the early part of my career, this was still happening, where they would essentially go into the basal ganglia and cut one of the circuits in order to compensate for deficiencies elsewhere in that circuit. A very crude way of treating it, but you know, it could work in that you could, on one side of the body at least, significantly reduce the tremor, which might improve somebody's functionality. It's not a, obviously not a cure. You're making a hole in the brain, but it would make a different set of symptoms that were not as bad as the original set of symptoms of the disease. So I had one patient was very aggressively treating, you know, seeking treatment for his Parkinson's disease, and in two different ways significantly hurt himself by doing this. One was that he had a bilateral procedure, meaning on both sides of the brain, and very early on when they started doing this procedure, they didn't realize that by doing it on both sides of the brain, you can cause very severe side effects. You do it on one side of the brain, the other side can take over. But when you do it on both sides of the brain, one of the things that it can cause is complete mutism. And so this guy was completely mute, couldn't say a word because of the surgery that he had.
Another one that sticks out in my mind is sort of an archaic treatment, and one that got, I think, a little bit worse of a rap than it should have, was electroconvulsive therapy. This is the typical shock therapy that has been portrayed often in the media. And it was used for pretty much everything in the early 1900s. Schizophrenia, sexual deviancy, epilepsy, anything, and basically just pass a high current through the brain. And it turned out that for most of these syndromes and most of these diseases, it was ineffective. You know, when scientific medicine really started to kick in this field, they actually showed that for most of the stuff, it's completely bunk and you're exposing the patient, who is most oftenly sedated and not awake for the, not fully awake for the procedure. But it showed that for people who are treatment resistant for severe depression, that it's actually very useful. However, right now it's being supplanted by a new method that's less invasive, something called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which involves passing a magnetic field that is rapidly oscillating and therefore can do the same thing functionally, which is basically reset the system that controls your level of emotional arousal without having to pass a high current through the entire brain.
Well, but the way that evolved was initially they would shock essentially the whole brain. Yeah. Then they realized, hey, we could just do one hemisphere and get the same benefit. So they went to just doing one side of the brain rather than both. Then they realized, hey, we could just do the temporal lobe. We don't have to do the whole, even whole one whole side of the brain. So then they just started doing the temporal lobe. And each time they focused in on this, they were still getting the same benefit for major depression, but with fewer side effects, like loss of memory and, you know, significant side effects. And then now the transcranial magnetic stimulation, that's the next step, where we're going to use a magnetic field to induce an electrical current in the temporal lobe rather than passing electrical current directly there. And again, same effect, a little bit less invasive, a little bit less side effects. So that's been the evolution of that procedure. It's still, at its core, electroconvulsive therapy, like in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but it's the procedure itself is very different and much more precise and much fewer side effects.
What is the idea behind this then? Is it to basically reboot the brain?
Essentially. I mean, that's a good metaphor for just rebooting the brain. You know, exactly what's happening in the most reductionist sense is still a matter of research. Maybe Jason could speak to this in more detail, but the questions are, is it resetting the neurotransmitters? Is it just depleting neurotransmitters and then altering brain function in that way? Or is there actual some circuitry change that's going on, which seems a little bit less likely?
This is actually still an area of very active research. Yeah. We haven't quite figured out this puzzle yet. The brain is probably the most complex organ in the body, and it has been said that if the human brain was simple enough for us to understand with our current level of technology and science, that we'd be too dumb to understand it.
Right.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Dr. Stephen Nebella, academic clinical neurologist at the Yale University School of Medicine, and Dr. Jason Schneiderman, postdoctoral researcher at the Psychiatry Neuroimaging Laboratory at Brigham and Women's Hospital of Harvard Medical School. So we've been talking about some of the more current research, and let's just keep talking about that. What are some of the studies that you've seen come out in the last while that you find fascinating?
As I said, the ones that showed, for me, that the changes that happened during adolescence, and it's actually when I started my doctoral work, I was told several times, oh, you're trying to compare adolescents and young adults, you're not going to find anything, like 15-year-olds versus 20-year-olds. And I couldn't get it published at first. The neurology journals and neuroscience journals all said, well, this is a pediatric population. And all the pediatric neurology and neuroscience journals all said, well, these people are too old. So eventually it did get published, and I did prove some naysayers wrong, but it seems to be sinking in more and more in the community in the last 10 years since I started my doctoral work. They've really understood that adolescence is a, you know, not just psychologically and behaviorally, but physiologically, there's a lot of change going on within the central nervous system.
Actually, what I find very interesting doesn't necessarily relate directly to my clinical practice, and that's just understanding how the different circuits in the brain generate our consciousness, right? So the consciousness research, like one question that is still an area of research, and I've been following it. My opinion about it has had to change pretty rapidly as the research comes in, is essentially where in the brain are we conscious? It's not everywhere. There are parts of the brain that don't contribute to consciousness. There are others that alter consciousness but are not necessary in order to be conscious. And then there are parts of the brain that are necessary for consciousness. One of the questions is there some circuit in the brain that is, I hate to use the term the seat of consciousness because that's such a cliche, but is there some circuit in the brain that all the other networks or circuits in the brain are reporting to? That concept was called the global workspace. Is there this one global workspace like your desktop or whatever where everything is sort of reporting to this thing and that's the thing that's actually conscious in the brain? Or is it just any bit of the brain is its own consciousness? So now you have this committee of almost different minds inside the brain that meld together into this one meta mind, which is you, which is your sense of yourself and your stream of consciousness. And it's everywhere in the brain. It's not in any one location. They're not reporting to any central location. They're just all, you know, contributing to the overall consciousness themselves. It's just the aggregate effect of all these little bits of the brain. That seems to be where the research is heading.
How do you find that out exactly?
By looking at the way the different circuits of the brain are activated and what happens when you give patients different tasks and see which parts of the brain light up. And then you can use transcranial magnetic stimulation to either, depending on the frequency, you can either increase or decrease the activity. You can basically really stimulate a part of the brain, a circuit in the brain, or you could turn off a circuit in the brain and you see what happens. And there essentially isn't any, you know, circuit in the brain that you could turn off that turns off consciousness, first of all. And second, that, you know, if you look at just one bit of the brain functioning, and you could show that altering that bit of the brain alters the consciousness that it contributes to. The simplest interpretation of the research we have so far seems to be that, nope, every bit of the brain is its own little consciousness, and it just all aggregates together to your sense of yourself. And when you turn off a circuit in the brain, the aggregate changes. It's now minus that thing. So, like, for example, with schizophrenia, let's say, just to make a simplistic model for it, you have some reality testing circuit in the brain. That circuit is dialed down or turned off or whatever, and the aggregate consciousness is now different. It's altered. It's minus that function. And how does the rest of the brain react to that? Well, things like interpreting the internal monologue as an external command, auditory hallucination. That is one of the manifestations. And now we could do this in the laboratory by doing transcranial magnetic stimulation, just turning off different parts of the brain and seeing how people how their reality changes. And can do all kinds of cool stuff to people now, including making them feel outside of their body. The thing that I find the most profound are the things that we're discovering about what the brain does that we didn't even realize it needed to do. This is like 100 years ago, if you said, list all the things the brain does, probably they wouldn't have listed, even the top neuroscientists of 100 years ago wouldn't have said, the brain needs to give you a sense of ownership over your own limbs. But it does. And we know that now because we can turn that off. And also we've identified strokes and lesions and circuits in the brain where if they're damaged, that ownership module is damaged, then you lose a sense of ownership. Or any circuit, if the circuits that are necessary to produce that sense of ownership, then what happens is you think that something else is controlling your limb. That's called alien hand syndrome. You're moving your arm, but you don't feel like you're controlling your arm because that circuit that tells you that you're controlling your arm is disrupted. Or you might have a stroke, for example, where the ownership module is intact, and that circuit is intact, but the limb it's connecting to has been damaged. The circuits that control the limb. So now you have this ownership module that doesn't have anything to own. So it creates an artificial limb, a phantom limb to own, and people imagine they have this extra arm coming out of them that they can control and feel and move. So doesn't seem to be any limit to this kind of manipulation of consciousness by altering the physical structure of the brain.
Well, let's talk about limits here for a second, because we can do amazing things now, as you said. But what are the limits of what we know currently about neurology?
Well, one thing, as wonderful as brain imaging is that we really can't get down past about the half a millimeter mark at the moment. So we can't see individual cells. We can't really tell what you're thinking. There are ways to do it where you could do a functional brain imaging, usually functional MRI, where you've trained the system to be able to identify, is, for example, the person thinking about an object or a person, or are they telling a lie or the truth? But it's one of those that Steve described. You're talking about a population. And so for no individual person can we really figure out what they're thinking. If we train them enough and train the system that we're going to show you a bunch of household objects and then a bunch of faces, and then we could tell from the MRI, you know, which one it is. But we're kind of far from that brain reading. For a long time, it's been very easy to read out what the brain is telling us. We could put electrodes in, we can do imaging, but it's very hard to get information into the brain other than your natural senses. I mean, the eye, the sensors in your skin, the ear, the nose and tongue are really good at conveying information in. And it's only been recently with an advance called optogenetics, where they can use specific frequencies of light to activate a subset of neurons and actually try to get encoded information back into the brain. Best way to get information into the brain is still, you know, your senses. And you've got more than five, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, that's the limitation. It's a resolution problem. The brain is functioning at an order of magnitude or two or three greater resolution than we have the ability to image it. So we're not looking at it's not just the individual neuron, it's actually the connections that neuron is making with other neurons, all the dendrites and axons. So that's another, you know, order of magnitude more detail that we need to get. And those connections are important to functionality. It's not just that neuron A is connecting to neuron B, it's, well, how many dendrites is making that connection? How tight are they? How close, physically close are they? What's the length of the gap? And what about the other cells that surround those neurons? They're modulating the function of those neurons at the same time. There's this other layer of complexity thrown in there. It's not they're not just passively keeping the neurons alive. They're actually modulating their function. So it's horrifically complicated. You know, I don't know if we're going to get to, you know, the Matrix. I know Kung Fu, you know, level of being able to, you know, communicate on that level with the brain. Just with the extrapolation of current imaging technologies, we may need the ability to really get there down there on the cellular level. I also think that the independent line of research that's really going to help us get there is by computer modeling the brain. When we actually control the virtual neurons in every detail because it's in a computer, and then we can manipulate every aspect of them because it's a virtual brain that we're creating, and then we can see how does this alter the function. You know, then we'll essentially reverse engineer the brain by creating a virtual model of it, and then when that process is, you know, at a reasonably complete stage, I think we'll also have an artificially intelligent computer program.
The main problem with that is that, as Steve says, every few years there's a major breakthrough of another level of complexity that we didn't think was there before. You know, I look back at my textbooks, even from graduate school, and look at the list of receptors for neurotransmitters, and the list has doubled since then. Yeah. We're always finding new molecules, new subtypes of neurons, you know, new functions for cells that we knew were there, but like the glia, these cells that surround neurons, as Steve were talking about, that were thought to be life support basically for a long time, and now we know they're actually modulatory and they're affecting the active mm-hmm. function. And, you know, we find new regulating molecules. We find out things like gases can be neurotransmitters, nitrous oxide being the right. big one. So computer modeling only goes to the current limit of understanding of the biology. But every single day we're learning it's right. a more and more complex system than we ever thought.
Well, scientists tend to pass through those phases yeah. where there's a phase where the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. So like if you're keeping track of how much do we know and how much do we don't know, how much we don't know gets bigger and bigger as what we do know gets bigger and bigger. But then you pass a tipping point where what we don't know then starts to go the other way, where, okay, now we're actually getting to a mature understanding of this system, whatever it is we're studying, and we're starting to answer more questions than is being generated by those answers, and maybe we're honing in on a reasonable understanding. There's always going to be more layers of complexity, but I think, you know, again, when we get to the virtual brain, where we literally control every detail in the program, well, you know, I'm assuming that actually that's an assumption that may not be true, because we may not be programming these from the top down. We may, to some degree, we may start to evolve, you know, these programs, in which case we don't control every detail. They may be emergent, et cetera. And we may not understand all the emergent properties of our own software.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at the medical effects of global climate change. We're joined by Dan Ferber and Paul Epstein to talk about their book, Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. And Josh Rosenau of the National Center for Science Education joins us to compare the denial tactics of advocates against climate change and evolution. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Does anyone have any questions for our guests?
It's football season. So my question has to do with concussions. You know, they've been doing studies on older players who are getting more and more brain damaged. And I just wondered why that is.
Our group at the Psychiatry Neuroimaging Lab is doing all the neuroimaging for the Boston University Center for Traumatic Encephalopathy, which are the ones who have been doing all the postmortem studies on the football players. They're the ones who have the NFL brain bank. Basically, what happens is after years of repeated concussions with improper recovery time allowed, is that there seems to be a type of cumulative damage in the brain that happens around the blood vessels. There's a buildup of a protein called tau. It gets phosphorylated, it starts to build up, and it basically turns into a neurodegenerative disease. And it can look like a lot of other things, depending on where in the brain it's occurring, and sometimes that can be based on where you get hit. You know, everything from ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease, to early onset Alzheimer's, early onset
Parkinson's.
Sometimes it can manifest as something like bipolar disorder or lack of emotional control, which is why you see, unfortunately, a high suicide rate in retired football players and other high impact sports players. Okay. So there's both a short-term risk, but then there's also a long-term risk that if you have a repeated history of this, you're going to get this, what we call a tauopathy in the brain. And this is what's made a lot of the headlines, because for years a lot of the sports organizations said, oh, concussion is nothing to worry about. Now we realize it is. But also the problem with the concussions, we're erring on the side of caution, which I think is the best thing. Right. But we have no good way other than pretty much a symptom checklist to look in the brain and see what's happening during concussion. Our laboratory is looking at a few methods, but these are things that are going to be at the experimental stage. They're going to have to go through the experimental, then they're going to have to go into human trials, and then it's going to take a decade or more.
Essentially, what he's saying is we break up how we can monitor the brain into two broad categories of approaches. One is essentially to do a neurological exam, give the patient tasks to do and see how they do them. The other way is to look directly at, with neuroimaging, et cetera, at the functioning of the brain. We're not really at the point yet where the neuroimaging is sophisticated enough, detailed enough to really see like the stunned brain and has it, when has it completely recovered. In addition, the exam that was being used to assess concussion was too perfunctory. It was just too, can you count to 10? All right, good, get back in there. You know, yeah, right, so follow my finger, you're good. Rather than like a more thorough exam to find more subtle deficits. And when they started doing that, they're not really recovering, even by the crude method of just having them do a full exam for like 6 weeks or so out from the injury, and maybe they really should be sitting out giving the brain more time
and
to recover.
Sometimes not even sitting out of athletics, but if the deficits are in something like memory, often it's sometimes best to pull a student. Sometimes a student needs to be pulled out of class. Mm-hmm.
If what your research has done shows that, you know, the damage is could be very serious for younger children, for teenagers, for high schoolers.
That's a large unknown at the moment, and we're erring on the side of caution with children and teenagers. And the clinical evidence has shown that basically you want to keep them out of heavy activity, both mental and physical, until they return are symptom-free. How you judge the symptom-free has actually been something that's been evolving. There are now some great computer programs that basically you've got to take a series of tests that are very hard to cheat on before you start playing football or ice hockey or rugby. And until you get close or back to your baseline, you know, plus or minus a certain error, you're not getting back in the game. But this is something that really hasn't pervaded the entire medical community so far. I work with one of the concussion experts, Dr. Robert Cantow, who has actually done some of these concussion testing stuff. And he is somewhat notorious for pulling students out of class at the college level. One thing that we have to do is get teachers, professors, and parents and coaches to understand. Yeah, 98%, 99%, whatever it is, of kids who get concussions are going to be completely fine. But we're erring on the side of caution here and want to make sure that none of these kids end up with, for example, second impact syndrome, which is where you get two concussions in a row, and that could lead very rarely to something like sudden cardiac arrest, or that you're setting this kid up for a higher risk down the road of developing a neurological degenerative disorder.
All right. As far as the more common disorders related to the brain that are known in the media, things like Alzheimer's, maybe even like ALD, something like that, which areas do you think hold the most promise as far as finding any kind of breakthrough given recent developments?
At the basic science level, there's been continuous breakthroughs, meaning that we're learning more and more and more about what's happening in the brain. What we haven't really figured out yet is that final piece of what's actually triggering the whole process. So essentially, we're learning more about the process of the degeneration. In fact, we have more clues than we know what to do with almost. It's like every time we look, hey, I wonder if, let's look and see if this is happening. Like, what's happening to axonal transport or calcium influx or whatever. Pick your marker of neuron function and, yeah, that's different. It's abnormal. And we could see how this can contribute to the degeneration of the brain cells. But that doesn't mean that that's what's different about those patients and that's what's causing it. And then if we take that basic science knowledge and try to design a treatment around it, it really hasn't been working out very well. You know, it hasn't led to all kinds of breakthrough treatments that actually stop or cure these degenerative diseases. My sense is that we're probably closest with Alzheimer's. We seem to understand that, I think, to a little bit deeper level than the others. But we don't know what we don't know. We're still at the point where we really can't predict when we're going to get enough information together that we could actually then start curing or even stopping the progression of these diseases.
As far as my view, I think it's also going to be the ones that we understand the most about the diseases, about the physiology, the genetics, the molecular mechanisms, stuff like Huntington's disease, Alzheimer's, we're going to see the most advances clinically. The ones that are further down the road, there's sort of this interesting vanishing divide between neurology and psychiatry. So all the things that are currently classified sort of as the classical neurological disorders, I think we're going to see a lot bigger breakthroughs as far as clinical impact than things that tend to fall more on the side of psychiatry, stuff like autism, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. Those are more that we know less than we don't know, whereas in stuff like Alzheimer's, we know more than we don't know.
I was recently at a coffee shop with a friend of mine having a conversation, and something I said was very specific, and it sort of made the words catch in my throat. And I immediately had a sense that I had said those exact things before. Mm-hmm. I had been in that same exact place reading the same words on the bakery case. Mm-hmm. And it was very specific memory. Are there any cutting-edge hypotheses as to what this is and what causes deja vu? Because it drives me nuts.
You know, other than reincarnation, you mean? That's not an uncommon phenomenon. Clinically, interestingly, one of the clues as to what might be going on is we see that happen in patients with seizures, that when they're having their aura, which is actually a seizure, it's just the early part of a seizure, having deja vu is one of the symptoms that can happen. So it can actually happen due to abnormal firing, electrical activity in the brain. The hypothesis that I've read about is that it's essentially happens in the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain responsible for that immediate sort of short-term memory. And it's essentially like just getting stuck in a little loop in the hippocampus, creating this illusion that of like an echo of a memory you're just having at the moment. So that's probably what it is, something like that, just an echo in the hippocampus, to use a metaphor.
They think it involves a process called reconsolidation. Our memories aren't as solid as we think they are. Every time you recall something, it becomes volatile to change. So with deja vu, it may be that you're recalling part of an old memory, and then it's getting hooked on to this new memory and sort of getting reformed. And therefore, part of it is old, part of it is new, and you're getting that sense that this is something that has happened before, or part of it is familiar.
You don't actually recall memories so much as you update and reconstruct memories. Every time you think you're remembering something, you're actually reconstructing it and updating it to accommodate for everything you've learned since then. So the memory just morphs to be consistent with what you think now is the narrative that you have in your head, which is why our memories are terrible sources of information. They're obviously practical to a certain extent, but you can't use them as detailed data because that's not what they are.
Childhood imaginary friends, do we know if those have any basis in brain development? And if so, is there any similarity at all to what happens in the brain for someone who has a disease like schizophrenia, who can't tell reality from not reality? Is that something that has to do with either anatomical or chemical brain development?
Yeah, it's basically the immature brain. It's not fully myelinated. You know, all these circuits are not fully developed or in place yet. Children are still, they're bringing on their functionality one at a time as they mature. So the ability to tell self from non-self, the ability to detect, you know, social things like when someone's telling the truth and when someone's not telling the truth, the ability to know that their fantasies are reality or not, again, sort of a reality testing thing. It's different. I don't think you could really say it's the same thing as schizophrenia. I don't think that children are young schizophrenics. You know what I mean?
No.
I think it's really different. I don't think you can make a one-to-one analogy between those two situations.
And it's one of those things that when you look back at people who are schizophrenic as adult or have bipolar, you're going to find some abnormalities in their childhood that are different from the population at large. Like you see that people with schizophrenia are later to walk and talk, but they're still so within the normal distribution that there's no way to tell them apart at the time when they're kids. You know, they're still within that normal growth curve because not everyone is the same. So imaginary friends or sort of this fantasy world that most kids go through is not harmful, and it's usually something that is unrelated to later hallucinations or delusions. If you have a kid with an imaginary friend, it's fine. I'd start worrying when about the point where they're higher cognitive and social cognitive skills start kicking in, which usually tends to be around puberty. Like if they don't go away by the time that they're in middle school.
Then they become a psychic, right?
Yeah.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thanks very much to everyone that came, and thanks very much to Steve and Jason for being here.
Thank you, Desiree. Thank you.
Before we go, we wanted to let you know about an exciting new project and a new way that you can connect to Skeptically Speaking. The United States National Science Foundation has just launched Science 360 Radio, a new 24/7 audio stream. It features over 100 science radio shows and podcasts from around the world, and Skeptically Speaking is proud to be a part of that lineup. You can get the stream on the web or through apps for your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. For more information, check out their website at science360.gov/radio. Thanks for listening.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online, reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter.
Skeptically Speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.